Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight number 133, recording on Friday, 27th of August, 2010. It's just myself, Steve Litchfield, and with me I have, of course, the inimitable...
Rafe Blanford.
Who has written a number of interesting bits on the site, which we'll be coming to shortly. I guess we ought to kick off, Rafe, with the big device launch of the week, and it wasn't so much a huge flagship device for everyone to salivate over. It was more something really aimed at the real beginners to smartphones, the people who are down buying in the high street, I guess. The 5250, I'll just run through the basic specs before you give your kind of analysis of where it fits in. Essentially, it's a cut-down version of things like the 5230 and 5800, which Rafe's done a good comparison table to over on the site, allaboutsymbian.com, which you can read through. Essentially, they've cut costs by having that no memory card. It's a 2.8-inch screen rather than the 3.2. The battery's lower at 1,000 mAh. Camera is 2 megapixels, same as 5230, and there's no 3G, and obviously no Wi-Fi, no GPS. So really, they've ripped out everything they could possibly rip out while still keeping a Symbian smartphone. But the big headline thing is the price, and this is just purely my guess, but I'm guessing it's going to be down £50 or so on pay-as-you-go in the high street shops. And I think, Rafe, you came to the same guess, at roughly £50.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the £50 level is maybe a little bit on the generous side, because obviously the margins get smaller and smaller, but on good deals you should get it down at the around 50 quid mark. I mean, in terms of SIM free pricing, when it launches it'll probably be about £110. That's only undercutting the 5230 by about a tenner, but as with all these devices, it will drop quite quickly, and I would imagine it will stabilize well under £100. And if you allow for a £30 or so pair, you go subsidy, and these figures are all for the UK obviously. That's what you get. Looking in other markets, you'll see similar amounts. I mean, essentially what you have here is a 30% reduction on the 5230. And just as the 5230 opened up smartphones to more people, so will the 5250. And, you know, Steve is quite right. You wonder what else Nokia can cut out. And that was kind of the main focus of the piece that I did. I mean, I actually think really the only really significant one in some ways is the lack of a GPS. All the others, while they may impair the sort of user experience, i.e., you know, you might not have the fast downloads provided by 3G or Wi-Fi, you might have a slightly smaller screen, you know, hard to use, slightly more fiddly when, you know, using the UI, trying to press some of the buttons on the screen. And similarly for things like Wi-Fi and also the slightly reduced battery size, none of those actually take away functionality as such. The one exception there is GPS. And although we talk a lot about location and how it's hyped, relatively speaking, those services are only just arriving. I mean, it's in the last couple of years that the idea of GPS navigation on phones has really taken off. And you could argue it's only with Nokia and Google providing completely free sort of navigation software that thing is sort of taken off and established itself in the mid-tier. And what we're looking at here, obviously, is pretty much a low-end device. But to put it into perspective, you'd be able to buy 20 of these devices on pay-as-you-go for every iPhone you bought. And so it does, I think, quite nicely illustrate the difference between the high end of the smartphone market and the low end of the smartphone market. We did have quite a bit of commentary coming back saying, this isn't a smartphone, you know, how dare you, etc. We've commented on this loads of times before, but it is worth emphasising, this is, of course, running Symbian 1, so therefore, as far as we're concerned, it is a smartphone. And as I say, the thing that makes it a smartphone that, you know, Steve talked a lot about in the definition article a while back, but it came down to the ability to add on third-party native software, and even that's slightly clunky, but it's sort of the ability to add in easy-to-use third-party extras, i.e. when you get it out of the box, you can really extend it. If you look at the feature phones, yes, you can install Java games and some Java applications, but there is a clear difference between the two, I think. And, you know, this idea of extending your phone after it's come out of the box has, you know, gained more and more currency, both in, obviously, in the high end and the low end. Now, I would agree with people that usage patterns will vary. So, you know, people using something like the 5250 will download different sorts of applications and different quantities of application to someone, say, using an iPhone or an N8 or whatever it happens to be. But, of course, you have to set that against the fact there'll be a lot more of devices like the 5250 on the market. And I did some very back-of-the-envelope calculations, and I reckoned that even if the usage patterns were sort of 30 or 40 times greater on the high-end devices, i.e. for every application downloaded on the 5250 and similar devices, you'd have to have 40 applications being downloaded on the iPhone, the N8, whatever it happened to be, to sort of reach parity in terms of the volume calculation differentiation there. That may be a bit generous because I made some assumptions about various sales figures and things like that. And it obviously depends where you draw the line for high-end, low-end, et cetera, et cetera. But certainly it is a factor of 10, 20 or more in terms of, you know, what you need to take account of the volume. So, you know, those who say that you're only going to make profit by selling application or service on the high-end devices, I think at the moment that's probably true to a large extent, but I really expect that to change very much in the next few years. Yeah. You know, just as with the ringtone market, that started on high-end devices, so with the low-end devices, you know, you'll get that in time. And I think, you know, ringtones were pretty rapid in their spread down the market tiers, and I think applications will possibly be even quicker, thanks in part, of course, to the fact that, you know, we're standardizing on these smartphone platforms. The one caveat in all of this is, of course, you know, smartphones do only still make up a relatively minor part of the market. It's growing all the time. It obviously depends which market you look at. In some markets, it's as much as a third of the sales of phones altogether. In others, it's less than 5%. But it's quite clear there's a trend going on to more and more smartphones, more and more applications, and that has implications for anyone who might be looking to profit from them.
Yeah, the big loss, if you like, looking at the things that Nokia, quote, cut out to make the 5250. I mean, we mentioned the screen size there at 2.8 inches rather than 3.2. That's a biggie. I mean, now, just looking at low-end users, the one thing they will still want to do, never mind their smartphone pretensions, they will want to enter text messages. And they'll want to enter text at a reasonable speed, even if it's only, hi there, hi mum, how are you doing, happy birthday, whatever. It trying to do touch typing or, you know, finger typing on a virtual QWERTY keyboard that's 2.8 inches in diameter, in diagonal, that's very, very fiddly. And with no writing aids, which I don't believe the 5250 will have because it's Symbian 1, that's going to lead to an awful lot of typos, and people can get very, very frustrated and a bit long for their, you know, their BlackBerrys and their T9 phones back, I reckon.
You know, I agree with you that this is definitely a big issue. I think it particularly affects Symbian phones because, as you mentioned, some of the writing aids, but it just as much applies to Android as well. You and I have had a similar experience trying out some of the lower cost Android devices. I would set that against that. I think typically people on this phone are going to use the sort of virtual T9 keyboard rather than a virtual QWERTY,
which is actually only
accessible in landscape mode. And so added to that, you know, the Nokia have actually produced another device around this sort of series, which is the 5530, which is a bit of an odd man out, but does have its fans. And actually, for me at least, had a better design. And that's basically the same specs, I think, as the, well, it's actually a cross between the 5230 and a couple of other. Anyway, should make it clear, it's got Wi-Fi, but it's not 3G, no GPS. But I actually got on fine with that device in terms of the screen size, because it did have the flat screen rather than the big bevel that we've seen on the 5200. Yeah. And the 5250 does share that characteristic, so I wonder whether that will make a difference. But I agree with you. You know, I haven't really had text input satisfactorily solved on sort of touch-only devices, full stop, apart from the very high-end ones where you do tend to get this sort of input aids of some description or other, and the higher quality screens, which tend to be a bit more sensitive to the touch. You know, people talk about things like swipe. I think that's a possibility, but I think there's room for plenty of innovation to sort of see some alternative ideas come in here.
Yeah, we really shouldn't discount the fact that all of these devices have a virtual T9 pad, and effectively the phone looks like and behaves like a normal traditional phone, and people can tap away quite happily with multi-tap or predictive T9 text using their thumb, and that works just fine. I think, and then, you know, Ewan's a particular fan of this method on his 5800, so that should work, if anything, even better on the 5250.
Yeah, it's what I always use on Nokia's touchscreen devices. I can't say I've ever really got on with the full-size QWERTY keyboards on the resistive screens. Even on something like the Nokia X6, I think most of the time when I'm entering text, I tend to use the sort of virtual T9 keyboard. a superior way. And partly that's because I got so used to using the 12-key keypads from non-touch phones, of course. But for a lot of people, that's what they're familiar with. And of course, that's what we have to think about when looking at a device at this price point. You know, yes, the price is a effort in terms of what you can put in quality components, but it's also what people are used to doing. Where will they be coming from? And I think a lot of people upgrading to this phone might not be their first touch phone, but it's quite likely to be their first smartphone or one of their very first smartphones. I don't really see an existing smartphone user picking up the 5250 unless they're using it as a second-hand device. As we mentioned this before, but I could see picking up a 5250 to use almost as a disposable smartphone when you're going somewhere in a high-risk environment, be it a music festival or something like that. But of course, I think the market for that is dwarfed by the people buying it as their only device, and particularly looking at markets outside maybe Europe, particularly maybe Latin America, Africa, and some bits of Asia and India, where they don't have 3G signal, Wi-Fi isn't particularly widespread. Cost is obviously a big consideration. Something like the 5250, I fully expect it to follow in the footsteps of the 5230 as a bestseller. I think Nokia have something that haven't really got any competition in terms of other smartphone devices on the market. It's going to be competing with Samsung and LG's feature phones that are touchscreen enabled rather than anything else.
And of course, we shouldn't forget the fact that Nokia has this incredible distribution network into those countries you just mentioned, and some of the Silicon Valley's favorite manufacturers and devices just won't get anywhere near these countries, partly because the devices would be too expensive, but partly because the distribution just isn't there. So that's one area where Nokia really shines.
Absolutely. We mentioned it before, but Steve, I think perhaps we probably bored people enough with the 5250, and we've pointed out this is a very important device, but I know a lot of people listening to this will have little interest on it beyond the sort of implications of it. So we should maybe have some more high-tech content for this podcast before we send everyone to sleep with another low-cost Nokia phone.
Going to the mid-tier, the E5 is due for review any day now. It is supposed to arrive this week and utterly failed to do so. But that is imminent on All About Zoom In. And of course, the second I get a Nokia N8, I'll be posting on the site. So do watch out in early September. Also, brand new on the site in the last week or so, I've been adding something in the region of 40 to 50 mini Q&As, which were originally written by myself for Smartphone Essentials magazine over 2008, 2009. And they're covering all different platforms, and many of them are multi-platform. So S65th edition, 3rd edition, even UIQ, some even Series 80 going back there if they apply to more than one Symbian platform. So if you have got a particular query, then do browse through those, and hopefully people coming into the site via Google when they're searching for a particular problem, that may well increase the number of visitors to the site, which will benefit us all in the long run. But do pass the news of this extra support section. It's been there for a while, but this is another big update to some of your friends who are perhaps having problems with their devices. OviMaps, in the last week or so, has yet another new plugin to its extensible home screen. As of version 3.3 and 3.4, you get this sort of more thing you tap on, and it lists all the extra services. And it's really almost becoming like a mini application ecosystem in its own right. Some of the things that are in OviMaps now are very much standalone applications on other platforms. And the very latest is Book a Table, which I know you've been trying, Rafe.
Yeah, this is a restaurant booking service, i.e. you are able to, rather than phone up a restaurant and find out where they've got availability, do it all from the comfort of your phone. Clearly, there's restrictions about this, but it works quite simply. You fire up Book a Table, it gives you a list of restaurants near you, or you can do a search if you prefer. You get a brief description, a little picture of it, and it's basically a mobile web version of the bookatable.com main website. And you fill in the time that you'd like to eat, specify whether it's going to be a lunch or evening meal, how many people there are, and it will give you some available slots. And then it's one more tap, fill in your name and a contact number, and you've booked the table. All works very smoothly and very easy. Try this out in practice, and it worked in a local pub, worked without any problem whatsoever. And you're right, it's great to see these continued additions to Ovi Maps. There may come a time, of course, when they're a question about how you manage them, and maybe you want to have favourites at the top of your list. But for the time being, there's still only five or six of them. Whether it's available in your market or not depends on whether the service is available. And some countries will only have a couple of these entries. Some, like the UK, Finland, and the US, now have six or seven entries into this. Just as a point of interest, these really herald what's coming next for Ovi Maps, which is essentially, as Steve suggested there, a sort of application ecosystem sitting on top of Ovi Maps. You know, about a year and a half ago, Nokia started previewing this and sort of referred to it as apps on maps, and we wrote about it on the site. We're actually still waiting for the kind of launch of this, and I know that Nokia have been working hard behind the scenes as to how they're going to practically implement it, and I suspect we may well be hearing about this at Nokia World in a few weeks' time, or at least, if not Nokia World, then later in the year, because this is a pretty new area, and it's the idea, you know, putting your applications on maps, what's the best way to handle them? Should it work in the sort of traditional application framework, or should you seek to do it in a different way? In terms of the actual technical side of things, it's all going to be done in web runtime, so you can build a web runtime application and sort of sit it on top of the map. We've already seen some of these applications, for example, TripAdvisor, becoming available as standalone applications in addition to being in Ovi Maps, and clearly there's a crossover and development time saving that can go on there. But it's you know, the idea of individual applications that operate within their own silos will increasingly go away, and I think location is one of the areas where we see this most clearly, because it makes more sense to make this kind of functionality available within the map, because that's where you really want to have that functionality. You know, you don't want to think, right, I need to find a restaurant, let's open up one of two booking services or TripAdvisor or whatever it happens to be. The chances are you're probably already using Ovi Maps, or you can use Ovi Maps as a centralized way of getting at things. And this, as we've hinted before, is exactly the reason why Nokia started giving navigation and sat-nav away for free earlier in the year. They believe the sort of ecosystem and the application framework they can build on top of Ovi Maps will be far more significant than any revenue that they can get from satellite navigation licenses. And indeed, they said, you know, it's pretty clear that they were going to go free, and with Google doing it, with their navigation service as well, I think that prediction's rather come true. And I'm sure we'll see other free navigation services before too long. And actually, the real race now is who can build the most sustainable ecosystem that's actually profitable for everybody involved, both Nokia and, of course, the third-party developers, quickest. So it'll be a very interesting one to watch. And I'm quite curious to see how Nokia have actually decided to implement this. You know, do you add icons to the home screen of Ovi Maps? Do you hide them under an extras icon, as is done at the moment? Or do you come up with something a bit more radical? So we shall see. And as I say, I think it's pretty safe to say that that will be coming out before the end of the year. But I've been proved wrong before, so wait and see.
Yeah, so that's Booker Table in Ovi Maps. I'm very, just to take you back to your experience, Reg, you say you actually tried it out with the local bar. I'm just curious how that works from the pub's point of view. So, you know, you do your booking, you tap on your Nokia screen, and something gets wired off via the interwebs. So you just picture the scene at your local pub, and did you get some the manager's on his PC, and he gets an email, and he says, "Oi, Sheila, stick down a booking for table 7. There's a Mr. Blandford coming in." How does it actually work for, you know, the local establishment, which is not particularly high tech?
Okay, well, the way this works is you actually have to register a restaurant on the service before it gets into it, and Booker Table currently has about 6,000 restaurants on it. And it just so happened that one of them was a pub quite local to me, and to be fair, it's a relatively high-end pub. And what they do is there's actually a background service, the name of which escapes me at the moment, but we'll stick it in the show notes, through which Booker Table works. And it also uses the same system to sort of provide online booking through Expedia and another number of other travel websites. And it also means that restaurants and pubs can add online booking to their own websites. And Booker Table is obviously piggybacking off that service, if you like. So there will presumably be a PC sitting somewhere in the restaurant, and, you know, they signed up for this service, which basically helps them manage their tables and get bookings from, you know, other destinations, other places. So when I arrived, it was just a case of, as usual, when you arrive, you know, you give your name and say, "Ah, yes, sir, right this way," and there you go, and you're seated. So there isn't any sort of receipt or anything you need to keep track of. And really, it's, you know, just a case of tying into existing booking services that already exist. And of course, I think, you know, you won't ever see this go universal, because a lot of places will retain sort of a book or a paper system for booking tables. But for a certain type of restaurant, it's actually going to make sense to do this. You know, they have an easy way to organise their bookings, and increasingly people are going to want to book online. And so Booker Table is just the front end of the service, if you like, for mobile devices. It can be used in many other ways, either directly when on a PC in the restaurant itself, you know, on their own website, you know, on some other travel website, you know, potentially, you know, travel agents and things could book things up in advance. And of course, you know, where the money gets made is the middleman takes a little bit of the cut, and I imagine Booker Table takes a bit of the cut as well. But for you know, most people running a restaurant, I imagine 10% to sort of, you know, guarantee that you're filling up the restaurant every evening is, you know, an acceptable thing to take on board.
Yeah. Ah, yes, Mr. Blandford, this way, please, to your table at the, in the VIP area. I can just picture it.
Well, not quite VIP, maybe, but yes. I mean, as I say, I was sort of impressed. I mean, to be fair, I could have not bothered with booking a table at all because there was plenty of space left. But I can see it being very useful, particularly in a foreign city. And, you know, there's Open Table. It's another company that provides very similar service, also has an application for Nokia and Symbian devices. Yep. You know, when you're abroad and you need to find a restaurant and you want to be sure of getting something, you know, it's a great way to go about it. I do miss the kind of the personal recommendation, but clearly there's obviously applications could be improved by sort of adding in reviews and things like that, which Booker Table doesn't have, Open Table does have. So Open Table would still be my preference, but the actual application of Open Table is rather sluggish in operation, whereas Booker Table was extremely fast. I think I had the table all booked in just a couple of minutes. So certainly a lot faster than making a phone call. Thumbs up from me, really.
Okay. Here's a forward-looking, future-looking news item about Nokia and Intel. Now, normally they say a picture paints worth a thousand words. And in this case, Rafe didn't do any pictures whatsoever, so I'm faced with looking at a thousand words of Rafe text. Nokia and Intel have announced the establishment of a joint research centre based in Finland. We'll have 24 researchers and focus on mobile user experiences with a particular emphasis on 3D. Rafe, how did you manage to avoid the temptation to stick pictures in your news story?
Well, this is the trouble with research labs, especially when they first open. They haven't got any pictures to illustrate it. And so I had a choice between putting in nothing or putting in a picture of Oulu University. I probably mispronounced that, so I apologise to all the Finns listening to the podcast. And I didn't really think there was much point in just putting in a picture for the sake of it. But this is the news that Nokia and Intel, who, of course, are already collaborating on MeeGo, have opened a joint lab to sort of look at 3D mobile user experiences. Most of this effort is actually going to be done in terms of research on top of MeeGo, but that doesn't really shouldn't surprise people. A lot of Nokia's existing research and development, particularly in the NRC activities, is already taking place on top of MeeMo. When I went to Finland to sort of see their Open Innovation Day, a lot of the demos were running on MeeMo simply because it's more open in terms of some of the available languages to program in, but more the ability to add in extra bits and use upstream components from open source. So as I say, building it on MeeGo, but it will have very broad applicability. So it won't just be for MeeGo devices. It will also apply to Symbian devices. Intel will use it in their, you know, in devices that come from some of their partners, laptops and everything else as well. So what they're looking at is, you know, how can 3D be used to enhance user experience? And it's not just 3D as in Avatar at the cinema. This is 3D as in sort of virtual worlds. Think Second Life or your typical 3D shoot 'em up. Can this be applied to real world applications? One that was mentioned was the idea of, you know, having a 3D recreation of your home and using it to control light switches, the toaster, the oven, the fridge, fans, etc., all around your house, you know, remotely. It does strike me as a bit lazy, but I, you know, clearly there's quite a lot of excitement in there. On a bigger scale, you can imagine the entire world being recreated in a 3D virtual environment and it being a way to explore it, because we're looking at ways to link the physical and the digital world, and I don't think anyone's yet come up with a really satisfactory, intuitive user experience. And with all this data that's being created on the internet and sort of metadata about the real world, linking them is going to become very important in terms of creating something that makes your phone your sort of second brain, or an addendum, sort of unlimited knowledge available for you at a push of a button. Of course, the irony here is it's probably not going to be push of a button. It's going to be, rather than point and click, it's going to maybe be gesture frameworks, something like that. But there's a lot of research to be done, which is why the lab's being opened. But you can also look at things like, you know, 3D user interface. And this is the idea that user interfaces could become, you know, layered rather than the sort of flat structures we tend to have at the moment. Can you make them 3D? And that could be done either on a 3D screen or indeed on a 2D screen with sort of 3D rendering. But the lab's sort of empowered to look at all sorts of areas. And so, you know, when I was listening in on the briefing call on this, the idea came up, well, you know, could you do the Star Wars style holographic communication series? And well, that's a long way off. That's the kind of thing they'll be looking at. You know, how can you create a completely new experience using some of these technologies, you know, that will maybe radically change the way we use devices? And it's easy to sort of sniff and say, you know, there's no particular product coming out of this, or this is all pie in the sky, and shouldn't they be focusing on the present? But of course, you have to research this stuff initially to have any idea where things are going. And, you know, this may be quite long term, but something in this lab could lead to something that, you know, changes the way we use our devices. After all, if you look back on things like Symbian, you know, that started in the Cyan Organizer days and the research and development in the labs there, or indeed the sort of whole idea of having soft menus in mobile phones, which are pretty dominant throughout all user interface paradigms now, you know, came out of a research lab back in the 80s, I believe it was. So it's really looking to the future. I think just one other point of interest on this story is that, you know, Nokia and Intel have agreed that all of the research that comes out of this will be done in the open and will be available under open source licenses. The reason they've done this is they believe it will allow better collaboration with companies and other research organizations outside the lab, and will enable them to do this research quicker, get more ideas in, get better ideas in. But it's quite a departure from, you know, what's gone before in terms of doing research and development in a very closed manner. And I think, you know, people will obviously make a comparison here to the way Apple approaches things with near total secrecy, whereas Nokia, because it's, you know, a different sort of company in one sense, in that it looks to create standards and do things in the open that apply across its entire portfolio. You know, it looks to build devices for everyone on the planet. It has often quite different research aims, in that it's not looking about one technology for one device. It's looking about technology that can then be applied across its entire portfolio. And it's why, you know, we've got this open innovation model, which a lot of people are still skeptical about, that's sort of been embraced by Nokia and is actually through all of its research. And we see the typical links with something like Cambridge University, for example, where that's where the research for nanotechnology is going on. And again, it's being done out in the open. You can read the research papers if you want to. And this is going to lead to stuff like having your phone that changes color at the touch of a button, or is waterproof, or maybe generates electricity from sort of piezoelectrical motions and things like that. So it's an area I could talk a lot about because I find it really very interesting, but I appreciate it's a bit dry on an audio podcast, so perhaps I'll hand back over to Steve now.
Yes, and no pictures in that last audio segment either. Thank you for that, Ray. It is a bit dry, but do see the site over the coming months for more on where Nokia and Intel and others are going in terms of 3D interfaces. Now, I had the privilege in the week of reviewing a couple of items of particular interest. The Momax mains battery charger is from mobilefun.co.uk. One of these things that you think, why on earth didn't someone think of this earlier? Now, maybe I'm unusual, but I've got spare batteries sort of littering my office, really. I guess I've inherited them from older devices. And also, you know, when I particularly take to a device, I think, okay, well, I love this device, but I want to have an emergency battery for emergency use. And I just go onto Amazon, and for a tenner, I get a spare battery. But the point is, you have to use the device itself, usually, to charge it. So why not have a little mains charger that sits just plugged into your wall, and it's got a cavity. In this case, it will accept just about any Nokia battery, because the actual pin configuration on these Nokia batteries, I hadn't quite realized, it's common across almost the entire range. The spacing between the three connectors in terms of their distance from the top left corner of the battery. So by having a charger with a recess that's big enough and deep enough, you can just effectively nestle each battery into the corner of the recess, and they make contact. You push them up against the contacts, and it just charges. And it trickle charges any Nokia battery. It takes 4 or 5 hours. You're not going to hang around for it, but you just leave the battery in there, and then whenever you need a new battery in a hurry, I'll grab it off the charger. It's fully charged, ready to go. And several times already in the last week, it's saved my bacon.
I think this is a genius idea. Again, like you, I don't know why I didn't think of it myself, because I've got various batteries around. It's obviously going to benefit someone who's got more than one device hanging around. But even for those who just want to have a way of charging up a second battery without having to take the phone apart every time they want to do the charging, you know, works well. And yes, enjoyed reading your review, and I'm certainly going to order one myself.
Yeah, the second thing I was reviewing was something which Ewan can probably join us in, and you may say Ewan. Ewan's not on the podcast; he is now. But you, Mr. Spence, you've joined us
through the wonders of modern special effects.
Through the wonders of modern technology and materialization, we have Mr. Spence up in Edinburgh, and I was just about to go into my commenting on my review of Let's Golf, which is effectively a sort of an all singing, all dancing golf. Sort of fun game more than a simulation, but it's really well done on things like the iPhone and iPad. And this is Gameloft's Java conversion. Now, I have to say, it's just about the best Java game I've ever played in my life. But my question for the panel, and especially Ewan, is even programming Java as tightly as possible and writing the game as slickly and as prettily as possible still creates a gameplay, especially for a sports stroke action game, that's just not quite good enough. For example, in golf, you'll imagine, you know, the power bar, and you have to swing the club and time at the bottom of the power bar to time the shot properly. And the whatever it is, 20 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds it takes for the Java runtime to accept a screen tap and process it and pass it on to the core code, that just takes too long. And by the time you've tapped the power and it's been registered, the power bar's moved on 20% and your shot's skewed off to the right or left. And I still struggle with the fact that game studios are writing, porting their games into Java and not into some sort of native Symbian system. What's your take on this, Ewan?
I think, first of all, there are two angles to take here. The first one is the pure tool question. You should be using the right tools for the job. And in an isolated case such as a golf game, there is a very, very strong argument, as you've made there, for a C++ version or native code version on other platforms to be used for the issues that you've mentioned. But on the other hand, this is the real world. There are costs involved in developing these games. There are costs involved in learning a system. And that cost impact of conversion has to be decided. There's an impact in conversion of going from Java to Java. And there's also a cost from going from Java to C++. And that also goes through the procedures that Gameloft have internally, testing regimes, agreements that they might have with network carriers and such. Like, it might be that it is so expensive for them to produce a C++ application compared to a Java application, even though it may look like that it doesn't take that much more time or effort on the part of the developer. That puts these barriers in place. But at the same time, games can be hard. It is not a problem. You know, I mean, if you look at even modern games, and I'm going to use the example of MLB on the PlayStation 3 here, you still have to time the swing of your bar correctly. In that case, it's for pitching a baseball. But you don't press the button just as it passes the mark. You always press it just before. When you're landing a plane, you don't pull up the nose of the plane in real life. When you hit the runway, you pull it up just before. If you go back to, S3A Golf, you didn't press the button just as it hit the line, did you, Steve?
You know how to hurt a man.
You pressed it just before. It's called a game of skill. So, yes, Steve, basically what you're saying is, Gameloft, make this game easier for me. You know, I can agree with you, but at the same time, as someone who loves games, who loves that learning curve, you have to learn to compensate. I think Gameloft have done a fantastic conversion of this game. It really is a wonderful piece of code. And you know what? Learn how to play the game.
Yep. All right. That's a fair comment. Yeah. We have one final news item before we finish. We are running for slightly long, but it's to do with music. And I'm glad Ewan's joined us. Rafe, do you want to do the news item and then Ewan can pass comment?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the news that Nokia is effectively rebranding its music services in some countries from Nokia Music and Canswith Music over to Ovi Music and Ovi Music Unlimited, respectively. This applies to the UK, but also quite a few other European markets and a few places outside Europe as well. It's partly to reflect the fact that they need to align everything under the Ovi service umbrella, but I suspect it doesn't hurt also that some of these services perhaps didn't do as well as was expected, particularly with regards to Canswith Music. In terms of what's going to happen, most of this is just a branding exercise, but for Nokia Music users who have been accustomed to having DRM music in the form of WMA files, the good news is this switch will mean that we will be switching over to DRM-free MP3 files for what is now the Nokia Music service and will become Ovi Music. This will obviously have an a change both on the PC version of the website but also on the phone. At the moment, all the music shop icons on Nokia phones just launch a web page, so the changeover will be pretty much immediate. We're not entirely sure when this is going to happen, although the emails have gone out announcing the change, so I imagine it's not very far away at all. And so it's sort of two-tier question, I guess, for Ewan is, do you think this is going to make any difference, and how important do you think it is to sort of be going to DRM-free music in terms of the uptake of this service?
Oh, you got a couple of nice questions in there then. How important is the rebranding exercise? Let's take that one first. I'm going to assume that deciding to brand everything as Ovi and not something by Nokia with Nokia in the name was a good idea a couple of years ago. That's going to be my starting point. Why they decided to have Ovi as its overall name for service when they could have just went with Nokia Online or something, I don't know. But having a consistent message, having a consistent brand, having everything look relatively similar to the user when they go to the web pages. So, you know, if you understand Ovi Music, or then you will be able to understand Ovi Data, you will be able to understand Ovi Files, you'll be able to understand Ovi Where Am I and Where Is the Nearest Pizza.com, which I'm sure is in the offing. That's exactly the same sort of rigor that we've always asked them to apply to the UI layer on S60, and which will be applied at Symbian Hat 3 and Symbian Hat 4 going forward. So in that sense, this consolidation is going across the platform, not just in the handsets, but also in the software as well. And that can only be a good thing. Yes, there is a period of change now, and people will have to get used to that, but I don't think that's too much hardship. What they want to get is the new people coming in, the people as they go further down into the mass market who maybe aren't as forgiving of technical issues. They want to give them that consistent same feel, that same interface. So in that sense, I'm all for the rebranding exercise. Whoever they're paying to do the rebranding exercise, I suspect they're all for it as well, and they've said lots of nice words. The second issue, will I go straight to the second issue, or do we want to carry on discussing that one first? I shall go straight to the second issue then. The second issue of DRM changes and everything, I think, is actually even more important. In terms of online music stores, there are only a handful that have any serious clout in the eyes of the music industry. Apple's iTunes Music Store has to be one of them. The second one, to a certain extent, is Amazon's MP3 store, and they are all DRM-free MP3s that you can download. Now, they are likely to be dwarfed by the dark corners of the internet providing music, but the music industry love to have three or four people battling it over to try and get the best deal for the publishers. You see it with bands. It wasn't just enough to have the Beatles. You had to have the Beatles and the Rolling Stones fighting each other. You had to have Oasis and Blur fighting each other. So in this sense, they probably want another store that they can have some leverage on. And I suspect they feel that they have more leverage with Nokia than they do with Amazon and Apple. DRM-free music, certainly for the individual purchases, will make, I think, people much more confident to buy music on the handset because you know it's an MP3 file. You know you can listen to it in absolutely anywhere. You know you have data portability. As long as this is backed up with some nice changes in the Ovi Music application on the PC that allows you to transfer in both directions easy and seamlessly into a central place on your PC or desk-bound computer that you can get to, so that once you've got the MP3, you can move it over, or you can sync it down again. Although, remember, you know, you might not always have that capability. You might just want to dump everything off over the cable rather than download again because you're on a 3G data connection card on your PC or anything. Obviously, they haven't done anything with the comes with music unlimited, or Ovi Music Unlimited as it's going to be called. Now, that still retains DRM, but to a certain extent you still have that retained, something like when you go for the Spotify download, whatever you like, with Pandora in America and other issues as that. So I don't think it's vital. What this is doing is, and I would love to see the comparative numbers, certainly of Amazon versus Nokia's Music Store, is it brings Nokia's Music Store into line with everybody else. So, great. It's clarity of message. It's like, here you are, you can download it. It's exactly the same as downloading it from Amazon. It's exactly the same as downloading it from Apple to a certain extent. You can buy the DRM-4 on 29 compared to 99 cents. And it just, again, makes everything simpler for the newer users that are coming in. So, you know, should they have done this from the start? Yes. Would the music industry let them have done that from the start? No. Are they doing it now because they can? Yes. Is this a good thing? Yes. I'm incredibly positive about this. This is unusual.
Absolutely. Well, I completely agree with what Ewan said. I think there's one comment worth making here is, you know, Comes With Music has really only been successful in some of the emerging markets, certainly the numbers that have been rumoured, at least. We haven't actually had any formal release on that, but I think, judging by some of the things Nokia said, I think it's probably taken as read that Guns With Music wasn't the raging success they were hoping it would be. I don't necessarily think this sort of rebranding is a reflection of that failure. I think the problem with Guns With Music is it was maybe ahead of its time and it wasn't marketed or explained to the consumer very well.
It was a tough sell in the shops as well. It's like, why would I buy that?
Absolutely, huh? And there were sort of operating things. So, I guess we can touch on that another time, particularly if we get the final details on the relaunch. But I would also like to add to what Ewan said. To me, this, you know, particularly on the DRM side, but also in terms of the branding, in terms of keeping a consistent experience, consistent naming, is really the basic hygiene that Nokia needs to have if the music service is going to work. Whether it actually does work or not does then depend on sort of marketing initiatives and some of the execution going forward with, you know, some of the tools in terms of the desktop transfer that Ewan hinted at there. But the problem was previously, you know, that basic hygiene wasn't there because it was still DRM files. Now, DRM isn't necessarily noticed by the majority of consumers, but I do think it becomes a factor amongst more experienced users, particularly maybe some of the Western European markets, but also it has significant impact elsewhere where, you know, it's taken as read that everything should be DRM free. And as soon as you start putting barriers in user's way, they don't like that. And so, you know, this to me will be a chance for them to start again. And it's worth noting that Nokia Music is actually in Europe the number two provider of music in terms of music from mobile devices. Now, that's a very specific segment, you know, i.e. downloading music directly on your phone rather than via a PC, which I imagine where most music downloads still take place, which shows that the idea of Nokia as a music provider certainly could work, especially if they can tighten up some of the other areas. And I think that's what this will do. So it's primarily a branding exercise, but there is this DRM component that we've talked about. And this is, just to stress, this is for the pay-per-track or the a la carte store rather than for the unlimited sort of subscription service, which is Guns With Music or Ovi Music Unlimited. And I do think it's a chance for Nokia to have a go at this. And at the end of the day, with the hundreds of devices out there, the sort of tens of millions of users, there is potential for a big impact. And now that they've got the basics right, there we can see where it'll go from here. There's still a question about execution, and actually this is a summary that I think you could read into an awful lot of Nokia's service activities. You know, there's been a lot of criticism about Ovi over the years in terms of operation, but a lot of things have been tightened up, and I think you can see this in something like Ovi Maps, which has gone from being not terribly impressive to really, I think, market leading in many ways. Music is now sort of getting into shape. The Ovi Store, you know, launched rather disastrously, but has improved over time, and no doubt that will continue, you know, in due course. So, you know, Nokia is getting the sort of basic levels right. There's still a lot of work to do, particularly in some areas more than others, but they get that right, and that's when it starts getting interesting, because that's the point at which, you know, if they start, you know, really pushing on the marketing or the word of mouth takes off, their sheer scale, their volume will have an impact. And this is why, you know, people sometimes sort of write off Ovi and say, oh, Nokia should just drop this altogether. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. It's taken longer than it should have done. There's still problems. Nokia isn't necessarily the ideal company for producing software and services, but this transformation that they've been going through will take time. But ultimately, I still believe it's a very strong bet indeed.
It's also interesting to me that this is, it completely contrasts Nokia's approach to certainly software development than to other companies. Nokia have done all of this development in the clear. Everybody can see what's going on. Ovi has taken time to build up, and every misstep has been public. Every success has been public as well, but negative always drowns out the positive by a ratio of 10 to 1 online. Now, you contrast that with a company like Apple, who every bit of development is done siloed. Nobody sees anything until it is completely and utterly finished, and then it goes out, and then somebody goes, hold on, basic physics, Ariel. But the point here is that by doing all of this out in the open, Nokia are taking a different approach. It's that open approach. It's the one that they've encouraged Symbian to go forward with, and why they've been such big drivers with the Symbian Foundation. Whether that is the right approach or not is a huge point of debate that you could have on podcasts from now until the very end of time. But I think that it's been a very brave decision to put it all up there. And so when they do make changes and people go, oh, you failed, we say, well, yeah, but would you rather we fail in the laboratory, or would you like fail so everybody can learn something?
talking of podcasting until the very end of time. We've run rather long on this podcast. Thank you for bearing with us. Thank you, Rafe. Thank you, Ewan. The show notes for this podcast are at allaboutsymbian.com. Of course, our Twitter handles, if you want to get in touch with us direct or see what we're up to, I encourage you to follow at Rafe Blandford, at Steve Litchfield, if you're not sure of the spelling on either of those two, look it up on the web. Or at Ewan, nice and easy, E-W-A-N. Also at David Gilson, he's not here this week, but I'm sure we'll have him back next week. Thank you for bearing with us. We will see you all next week. If you want to say goodbye, guys.
Thanks very much.
Goodbye, guys.
See you, guys.